Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Long Night with Vish Khanna was recorded in front of a live studio audience at Spur Festival on Friday, April 8th, 2016.
Coming to you live from the Transact in Toronto, Canada, it's Long Night with Vish Khanna! On the show tonight, we have Ship Disturber and Dr. Karis Masarella here!
Welcome, everyone, to Long Night. James, that was...
Not great. It wasn't great.
Not a great introduction tonight. What happened, buddy?
I don't know. I choked. I felt like there was pressure. The crowd was way more literary and less drunk than usual. And
we are... Yeah. That's fine. Don't worry.
You did... You know, we can fix it in post.
We can fix it in post.
Before this goes out on the air.
How about a hand for James Keast, everyone? Nice. How are you doing?
I'm okay, thanks. How are you?
I'm okay, but there's a thing that's on my mind, and I was hoping that you and the people here could help me.
Probably. I often do.
James is a close confidant of mine. Here's the thing. As most of you know, I'm a very popular and famous TV show host. Everyone's always talking about me and television, but in my line of work, people often offer me other opportunities. And recently, a gentleman from a very big media company in Canada wanted to have a meeting with me to be an on-air personality. How about that? Yeah. So I, as you can see, those of you who can see me over the last few months, I have basically allowed the hair on my face to just have a very good time, right? Something is going on here. I can't figure it out. And I was telling a friend of mine that I have this opportunity, and I said, you know, I'll probably clean all this up, get a haircut, shave. And he said, yeah, and you should dye your hair. Now, I have received a lot of compliments, as you know, about my salt and pepper hair. It's quite lovely, isn't it? You have to admit. And so I was really taken aback by this. And, I've never dyed my hair. I know this might be a sore topic. Has anyone here dyed their hair? Not even to color it gray, just to dye. Linda, you dye your hair all the time, yeah? Do you like it?
It's okay. Well, now it's kind of, it's been established, so now I just have to keep on dyeing it forever.
That's right. Once you die, you can't go back, right? That's what I was told. If I die, if I die, this is getting kind of morbid.
There's no coming back from that.
But what do you think? Do you think that people on TV wouldn't accept me for who I am? Do I look like an old man? No offense to
anyone. I think the problem is that you have the reverse of what most men have, because most men have
It's not the first I've been told grayer, about this, by the way.
Most men have a grayer beard before their head hair goes gray.
Right.
And you've been a salt and pepper gentleman for a close to a decade, I'd
yes,
say.
Yes, yeah, since I was 18,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so it's the incongruity of the dark beard, I think, that throws off the look.
Oh.
But I've always admired your hair.
Yeah, people like my hair. Yeah. I get it all the time. But yeah. Now, I have to say, where the crisis has come in is I'm actually considering my friend's opinion. I'm actually considering, before I meet with this person, dyeing my hair, and it's making me crazy. Because I don't want to do it. I'm scared. I'm a little frightened. And I don't know what to do. What do you... I want the audience to maybe help me, because James is as helpful as ever. By show of applause... Actually, let's come up with a cheer. What would be a good cheer? How about this? If you think I should dye my hair black and try to look young, scream out as loud as you can, "Dye, Vish, dye." On the count of three. 1, 2, 3. No one wants me to die. One person.
One person wants you to die.
Security? No. And then everyone else thinks I should just keep it?
Yeah. What about the beard? Can we take a poll on the beard?
The beard is... What are you talking about with your beard,
buddy?
I have
a beautiful, luxurious beard.
You think my beard is
my look.
A farce? Is that what you're saying?
It doesn't necessarily...
Dye the beard.
You should dye the beard gray.
I don't know if it is. Dye what? Silver? Gray? What am I supposed to dye?
Pink.
Fuchsia? I would go with fuchsia. Mm. I just like saying fuchsia. Well, I feel like this is hopefully a nice segue into our show, because I think many of our guests have dealt with appearance and the appearance of things. How's that for a segue?
It's not bad.
I don't know if it's true, but I said
it. I already blew the intro. I can't say anything.
Yeah. On tonight's show, a conversation with highly decorated emergency physician and a leading expert on transgender care. Dr. Karis Mazzarella is here tonight. Also acclaimed journalist, author, and Middle East expert Hadani Ditmars, and Malaysian-Australian author, rapper, and poet Omar Musa. That's a good show. Those are good people. Give them a cheer. Now, we have to go to a commercial. We're going to go to a quick commercial. I'm being told we have to go to a commercial. So we'll go to a commercial. When we come back, we'll have our guests. Stay where you are. Thank you for being here at Long Night at Spurfest, everybody. Are you tired of listening to a podcast without some mention of the company's Squarespace? We are, too. That's why we're pleased to mention Squarespace on this podcast. What does Squarespace do? It doesn't matter. All you need to know is Squarespace pays a considerable amount of money to be mentioned on successful podcasts. So if you want to hear about a business on a podcast, always remember that Squarespace is a thing mentioned on podcasts, and they probably have an office space somewhere. That's Squarespace, a company that is mentioned on most successful podcasts. All right, we're back. We're back on Long Night. Now, we are recording this episode and transmitting live around the world the night the Blue Jays start playing the baseball.
That is true.
Is that how the kids talk?
The Raptors are also playing the basketball, and the Marlies are playing the ice ball.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff going on in Toronto. We'd like to, once again, thank you all for choosing us over all of those far more expensive options. Thank you. For coming to this relatively affordable thing. All right. Our first guest tonight is an attending emergency physician at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton and is the lead physician for the transgender care program at Quest CHC in St. Catharines. And she's a leading expert on transgender healthcare in Canada. And the Huffington Post has listed her as one of the world's top 50 transgender icons. Please welcome Dr. Karis Mazzarella. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
Good, thank you.
How are you enjoying your Spurfest?
Yeah, so far it's been pretty awesome.
What have you done here so far? Because I just...
So far I've drank a beer and talked with my fellow guests and met some great people.
Right. Well, I have to say I'm very honored and excited that there's a decorated physician here today. Because I have a kink in my neck.
Makes me sound like, when you say decorated physician, it makes me sound like a war hero, but thank you.
Do you think you can actually help? It's really a problem. Do you think maybe after the show, I'm just having some rotation issues or something, and I have a lot of issues. And
don't we all?
Yeah, I suppose that's true, yeah. Now, as I mentioned, you're an emergency physician. Mm. This means you treat people coming into the emergency room, I assume?
That's correct, yes.
Right. So I'm curious, what drew you to take on? Like, that's among the most intense forms of medical practice. Why would you want to do that to yourself?
Well, I think really most emergency physicians are doctors with undiagnosed ADHD. I mean, basically, we see people in snippets. We get very little information, and we just kind of act on instinct. So for me, I'm a high intensity. I like to do things at 100 miles an hour. So for me, emerge medicine was the perfect career. And so I just found myself in it. I trained in it. And I love it. And I actually worked a shift today, so it was pretty epic. Had a great time.
You worked a shift today and then came here?
I did, yes.
Did it go okay?
You might want to poll the patients about that, but I think it went well.
Okay. Now, when you say you have ADHD, or maybe it's inherent within you, are there other ways in life that this is exemplified? Like, is there any other instance where you're like, I'm a spaz. What's going on?
Well, I mean, I grew up in Northern Ontario, so I don't know if that influenced, my career choice and my life choices, but... I was exposed to a lot of sulfur dioxide as a child, so I don't know if that had a significant effect on me as a person. But, I mean, I think, for me, this whole way I live my life, which is at full speed, has allowed me to sort of achieve things, in a way that maybe other people wouldn't have done at that, in this way. So I think it just allows me to at least be successful in ways that maybe for other people it would be different. I don't even know what I'm really saying right now.
No, well, it's because you have the ADHD. You don't
right,
know
exactly. So I actually have like 10 thoughts going through my head
yeah.
right now.
No, that's fair. Now, you deal every day with situations where people's lives are hanging in the balance. Mm-hmm. I assume every day there are tragedies, there are triumphs. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it for you to not become emotionally involved when you're working with someone?
I think that's something that all doctors learn. At least you need to learn that, because if you do become emotionally involved, I think, unfortunately, it becomes very hard to practice. So, for example, just on Sunday, we had a 50-year-old guy who dropped dead in a waiting room. We ran a huge cardiac arrest code on this guy. He was basically having a large heart attack, and he passed away. And then 2 minutes later, I was in a room with a guy complaining about his sore toe for the last 6 months. And so really what you have to do is you have to put it aside and just, put it in sort of away. And sometimes, there are moments when you have to deal with it in a more meaningful way, especially when it's something that can resonate with you. But for me, it's just the idea that, it is your job. It's something that you need to do. It's something that you need to get past. And I don't dwell on it. I really can put it away. If I went home with it, I couldn't do this job.
But, okay, so you're dealing with this horrible tragedy of a fellow in the waiting room. Is sore toe guy entitled? Is sore toe guy saying, my sore toe? And you're like, dude, like a guy just...
Yeah, so sore toe guy actually did say to me, quite clearly, what took you so long? And I said, there was a guy who just died in the waiting room. He went, well, he's dead. I went, yes, he is, but...
He said, "Yeah, well, he's dead.
Yes, yes, yes. He said, well, he... And I went, yes, no, that's a fair point. However, as a physician, it's my duty to try and make him undead, which sounds vaguely... Horrific,
how sore was his toe?
To me, as an emergency physician, I felt that it wasn't sore enough to be in the emergency department. So I felt that maybe what I should do is make him spell the word emergency and then look it up in the dictionary. But
you can't do that. You can't do that.
There's only so many complaints that you can take.
You can't be sarcastic as the emergency room doctor, can you?
No, absolutely not. No,
probably
we're not like
can't.
That. We're very good people.
Now, it's safe to say that sometimes we as people, some of us are idiots and we do ridiculous things to our bodies and we end up in the emergency room.
Absolutely.
Can you think of something, have you encountered something so absurd that you're still kind of laughing about it?
Well, we always have something called the personal problem in the emergency department. So whenever you get a chart with personal problem, it's going to be a male age somewhere between 20 to 40 who's been doing things to himself he shouldn't. And he'll come to the emergency department. So one I particularly remember was a guy who, on his own accord, forged a titanium cock ring. And he forged it, yes, on his own, like a tool and die guy. And
a tool and die guy.
It's the theme tonight, I think.
It's very clever.
It's our theme. And yeah. So he placed this said titanium cock ring on his said member and became engorged. And however, as you know, steel, titanium is not a forgiving substance. So once he became engorged, he couldn't become unengorged. And however, he decided to wait a couple of days before he came to the emergency department. So when he arrived in the emergency department, the part of his member distal or beyond the titanium ring was somewhat blackened.
Oh.
Now, at that time, I hadn't transitioned, and I was like, ooh, not a bad idea. I think I was the only person in the department thinking that at that point in time.
That doesn't seem like an area in which you want to go DIY.
No.
No.
But it crossed my mind. Yeah, so, and you know, the only way you can get off that off was basically because it was so engorged, you actually had to use a steel cutter to get it off in the OR. See all the guys like, oh my God.
That's right. And what happened in the end?
He lost part of his personal space.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, how was his toe?
I
don't know. Did he have a sore
toe? You know, he also complained about that. No, he didn't.
Now, my understanding is that you transitioned to a woman from a man, and I can see why, because we're idiots, clearly. When you were 42 years old,
correct, yeah.
Which was like 8 years ago or something like that.
I like to think 32, but you can say 42.
32, right, fine, sorry. Yeah. What prompted you to do this?
Well, I think, you know, one of the interesting things when you ask people about, you know, who have experienced gender identity expression opposite to their assigned birth gender, which is essentially what a transgender person is, for me, like, I knew my whole life that, you know, that's who I was. And it wasn't, for me, it wasn't a revelation. But I think, you know, when you talk about dying, again, the theme tonight, as a transgender person, there's sort of two ways you die. Some people actually actively kill themselves, and that's why you look at a suicide rate or suicide attempt rate at about 45%. Mm. But you also die inside. And for me, I had reached a point where I was felt dead inside. And the only option I really felt I had to continue my life in a meaningful way was to transition. So, it was a difficult decision because it's not something, you know, to do in the middle of your life casually, especially when you've built a career as a physician and you have a family and you know, you live in Oakville, Canada's most diverse community. You know what I mean? So it was a difficult decision, but for me, it was the right decision.
Now, how soon after you transitioned did you feel like yourself?
So for me, I think it was something... you know, it's not, you know, you like to say it's almost immediate, but I think there's a learning curve, right, to living in your preferred gender, because there's a lot of things that are different in the way that the world perceives you. So, for example, you know, I'd been a doctor for many years prior to transition, and I had never been mistaken for anything but a doctor. But the minute I transitioned, people would say, oh, when's a doctor coming? And I'd be like, the doctor just came. And it was quite a shock to me. So it just sort of speaks to the patriarchy.
People were
misogyny.
Treating you as though you were the nurse.
Nurse, yeah. 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 And so there were lots of different ways that I had to adjust my life. And I would say I've really only become, you know, comfortable. Even then, I think there are still moments when I'm not entirely comfortable in the last year or two.
And now, obviously, you must have, you would not have maybe, I mean, lots of women go through this sexism.
Yeah,
and you probably didn't have that perspective, and now you do.
Yes.
What's that like?
I think it's eye-opening for me. So one of the things that I did learn was that, especially I think, you know, in the trans community, when you pass, so to speak, so for people, they look at me and, you know, in my day-to-day life, nobody knows that I'm a transgendered woman. And so you do experience sexism in a different way. And so for me, what I find is, as a woman, you're expected to, I think, take a back seat to men in some ways. One thing I like to talk about is the Starbucks effect, and it's like manspreading. And what I first noticed was when you go to Starbucks and you get a coffee, and I apologize for going to Starbucks for those of you who are opposed to that, but I live in Oakville, that's all we have. So I would go to Starbucks and you get your drink, and then you go to get your milk and your condiments with your coffee, and you'd watch a man there and he'd take up the entire space, like he'd manspread. And then you watch like three or four women and they would sort of take up the space together. And so I just found that there was a different sense of the way you take up space when you're female versus male. And I think that people expect you to take up less space. They expect you to be less, you know, not to be present in some ways. And so that was a learning experience for me. It doesn't mean I'm any less, you know, entitled or any less, I don't feel any less, but certainly I think society as a whole thinks of me differently.
Right.
Yeah. Approaches me differently.
I wonder why we take up so much room. This seems to be a trend. I mean, people talk about it on the subway all the time, the man-spreading thing.
I think it's also a confidence thing. One of the things that really interests me is men are taught it's okay to be confident. They're taught it's okay to be strong, be powerful, be aggressive. Whereas
not this guy. My parents were like, you are nothing. Stop.
No. And clearly they were on the right track. Obviously.
I agree.
But I think that one of the things that, you know, we need to teach our younger women is it's okay to be confident. It's okay to get what you want in life, you know? And I just think that that's a big difference. I really see that, at least in the world that I exist in.
Now, you've done a couple of TED Talks, including one a couple of years ago called The False Narrative of Deception. What was the nature of that talk?
Well, I think you see it now in the United States particularly. What I anticipated was there would be this bathroom issue. And, you know, there's this false trope that's passed on by people, you know, who don't like transgender people, actually don't really like anybody for that matter, who's not white, cisgendered, and heteronormative.
Right.
But these folks, you know, use the false trope that if you allow transgender people to identify in their gender and use the bathroom of their preferred gender, that you're going to allow, you know, predators into bathrooms to assault women and children. And I could see this coming, and it's been proven in the Houston Hero Ordinance, in North Carolina and Mississippi, all the very progressive states in America. And we've seen this, and it's a false trope, right? There's never been a single recorded case of a transgendered woman doing this. And what's even worse about this is that it doesn't apply to trans men. It doesn't apply to passing trans women. It's just non-passing trans women who they're talking about. But if you really wanted to use evidence, right, and if you really, really, really cared about evidence, right, people you'd ban from bathrooms, we know there are certain groups of individuals who have absolutely assaulted children and done this to children. And one of those groups would be, you know, clergy, right? We should really ban all clergy from bathrooms. We should ban teachers from bathrooms because they have all been convicted of assaulting children. So really, it's a horrible trope. It's false, and that's what I wanted to talk about. And let's just face it: when just like cisgendered people, when transgender people use the bathroom, they use it because they have to pee. It's that simple.
I mean, you mentioned North Carolina there, and they just passed this bathroom law. And as we're speaking, I don't know if it was today. Did you see that Bruce Springsteen canceled his concert in North Carolina?
I didn't see that. No, that's awesome.
How about a hand for Bruce Springsteen? He said to show solidarity with the LGBTQ
community. No, I think you know, you are seeing the backlash, and it's interesting. You know, you talk about that. I was trying to think of an analogy. I think that we've won the war, but there are still battles to be fought. And so I was thinking, like, you know, what people say, you know, if you're Second World War buffs, it just shows you how weird I am. But if you look at, like, Hitler, you know, when did Hitler lose the war? And you could argue that he lost the war at the gates of Moscow in December of 1941 when the German army was turned back. Now, nobody thought at that time, because that was the massive extent of German power, but they lost the war then. There were still battles to be fought, like at Stalingrad, Kharkov, Kursk, but the war was lost. And I think it's the same for us. The millennial generation, the Generation Y behind me, don't care about this issue. To them, it's about equality.
They don't care about it because it's not an issue.
Right, exactly. To them, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And so, we're going to have some battles that still need to be fought, like in North Carolina, Mississippi, in Houston. But ultimately, I think, you know, we have won the war.
It does seem to me that we're in a better place when it comes to the rise in profile and acceptance of transgender people in popular culture. You're saying you think we've made progress, obviously,
yes.
And we're seeing it in films, and
everything
feels positive.
Yep.
What is the Canada Family Action Council?
Well, they're a group of wonderful people who hate everyone. They're, you know, so-called social conservatives, and it's not just transgender people they dislike. They dislike homosexuals. They dislike people with progressive agendas. They basically dislike everyone who's not like them. But certainly they do have influence. They have influence with conservative senators in particular. So in the last parliament, when the elected representatives passed Bill C-279, which was a transgender rights bill, unfortunately it was defeated in the Senate, partially because of influence from these types of groups.
Right.
And in fact, the conservative members who voted in favor of the transgender rights bill, they would call, you know, CINOs or conservatives in name only. So they have influence in certain circles. Presumably with this government, they won't have the same amount of influence, but they exist, and they're the same people who 50 years ago would have been against interracial marriage.
It's so weird that all of these groups tend to invoke family.
Right.
Like that's their emotional heartstring pulling thing.
Right.
That we're a tribe and everyone else is What the? That's annoying. It's annoying to me that they do this, and I don't know when that is going to change.
Well, I agree with you, because, I mean, like, I come from a family. I don't know about you, but...
I sort of did.
Yeah. I mean, we've met your parents. They seem lovely.
Yeah, they seem lovely. Are they still here? Oh, thanks for sticking around. Mom and Dad. I need gas money from them later.
No.
Yeah.
No,
my family was mostly pretty great.
No, and same with my family, too. Like, my family was
very... They're
not
going to hear this. It's okay, James. James is worried about my... James came to my wedding. How about a hand for James? He came to the wedding. Yeah.
I came to two of your weddings.
Yeah, I did have two weddings. I had two weddings in one day. It was a bit much.
You had, like, the white wedding and the traditional...
We didn't call it that. But we did call it that.
Yeah. I have a few friends who told me that's what they call it.
Yeah, it was nice. It was actually very lovely. I know, family's great. I think family's great, but when you use it as a way of excluding people, it's so bizarre that you could say that. You could use a term that is meant to be this galvanizing thing, and we're going to alienate as many people as possible.
Well, just to me, they always seem so angry, too. Like, they're angry at everything.
Well, that's normal for a family.
I guess that's true. Fair point.
That part makes sense. Yeah. Now, you've been featured in documentaries. You're often asked to speak at events like this. I'm curious, are you thinking about a book? Is there any other media form? Like, what's next for you?
You know, people have asked me about that, and I always think, you know, if I was ever going to write a book, I'd want to actually have to say something interesting, and I'm not sure that I actually have anything interesting to say in the sense that...
I would disagree and would ask that the applause sign go up.
Thank you.
No, I do. Like, I mean, I watched your TED Talk. This has been fun. I mean, everything I've seen you do, and the appearances you made in the documentaries, you seem like you'd be a very compelling person. You are a very compelling person.
Thank you,
Vish. In real life.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, yeah, are you thinking about something?
I think, again, I have been approached by, you know, some TV producers about doing a show or something, and I'm just not sure. I mean, I really value my privacy as I sit on the stage and talk in front of all these people. I really value my privacy. But I do have two small children, and so some of the choices I make are around my girls, because I think they can't make those choices yet.
Yep.
And so I try to be a little bit careful, not entirely careful, clearly, but a little bit careful. And so I think at this point in time, I'm probably just going to keep doing what I'm doing.
Okay.
And try and make a difference that way.
I assume that the privacy would explain why, as far as I know, you don't have a Twitter, you don't seem to be on Facebook or anything like that.
I was on Facebook, but you know what I do like, though, which is ironic, which makes me sound, I like Snapchat.
That's fine. What's wrong with Snapchat?
No, well, I mean, I think it's the best flirting tool ever invented. I like it.
You like Snapchat?
I do.
What kinds of things do you send out on the Snapchat?
Become my friend, you'll find out.
Okay. All right. What, can people follow you on the Snapchat?
Yeah, you can, yeah.
What's
yeah.
your thing?
God, that's a good question. I think it's Karismas 8.
Okay, Karismas 8. All right.
So
well,
if you want to get a Snapchat from me, fire it up.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on this show. Thank you very much, Karis Mazzarella, everyone. Please stay. Still to come, conversations with Adani Ditmars and Omar Moussa. Plus, we're going to get Linda's take, which is always very exciting. We're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be right back. Another hand for Dr. Karis Mazzarella, everyone.
For your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure, Pizza Trocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily-made dough, homemade sauce, and fresh toppings cut by hand. Ask us for our 2-for-1 special. Pizza Trocadero, open weekdays till 9, weekends until 10. Located at 7 Municipal, north of College in Edinburgh. Proud to be an independent family-owned business. Call 519-829-2444 or visit trocadero.ca.
Hey, we're back. We're back. Nice to see you. Just a reminder that tonight's show will soon be appearing as an episode of the Creative Control Podcast, which is available on iTunes, audioboom.com, vishkana.com, and also cfru.ca. And we also have a Patreon page where you can make a monthly flexible donation to keep the podcast going. So that would be nice. Does anyone here contribute to the Patreon page? Uh-huh. Okay, that's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
Even your parents?
Not my parents. Mom, Dad? No. This joke is wearing thin. I feel for them. They're going to leave, just like my parents. Thank you. Thank you very much. So if you can, keep listening and spreading the word about creative control. You know, some days the world is so messed up you can't make any sense of it. It's times like these when we have no choice but to get Linda's take. I was wondering why there wasn't much applause going on. It's because you disappeared into the wings.
You
and
think I'm useless, but...
The people... Oh! Linda, it's nice to have you back on the show. It's always nice to have you tell us what your take is on things. So what's going on? What do you want to talk about?
Well, okay. I was going to come and just like make a million dick jokes and just be my regular core self. Usually this is on Long Winter, which is a dirtbag party. And people are like just drunk.
It's a sophisticated art salon.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a sophisticated art salon. It's just full of drunken bastards. And then tonight, all these people are so classy and they seem like well-read. Keist told me that they were professors, so I don't know. I feel
Keist told you that everyone on the show is a professor?
No, not on the show.
Not just the show.
In the audience.
Everyone is a professor.
Anybody here a professor?
They're liars.
Welcome.
Too.
It's nice to have you here. Professors, you're right. Wow.
So,
What does this mean for Linda's take?
It means I'm shy. You know, I don't want to let the tiger out of the cage.
I think everyone would encourage Linda, with or without the applause sign, to be herself, right?
Do you have any questions for a representative of hot young millennials such as myself? Like,
no. I mean, it's your take. Whatever you want to talk about.
My take?
Right. Remember, we said you'd. This happens every time.
Yeah.
We said, you'll come up with a topic
and
tell me about it, and then I'll ask you questions about it. But I don't make up the topic. It's your take.
Oh, okay.
You come up with the subject matter. We emailed about this.
Yes.
Again.
Yes.
I'm starting to feel like this whole segment is just me yelling at you for not doing the segment.
I like it a lot. It's my favorite segment.
Is there something you'd like to talk about today, Linda?
Well, I was kind of intrigued when you were talking about dyeing your hair because I never thought of that before. How
That's
you have a black
my
beard.
Take. That's my
but it's
thing.
It's my take on your take, isn't
okay,
it?
Okay, fine. What do you have to say about what I said?
Well, I would encourage you not to dye your hair because once you start dyeing your hair, people make requests and it's really annoying.
People make requests about what?
Like, I used to have blue hair and people were like, I miss the blue hair. And it's like, that's a rude thing to say to somebody, I feel like, to ask them to change their head for you.
Right,
like,
yeah,
I don't
that's
know.
Kind of, it's a certain level of intimacy that I'm not comfortable with myself, sure.
Exactly.
Okay.
But you're a guy, so you're allowed to have gray hairs, like, no offense, but I have all these grays. Like, I know I just said I was a hot young millennium, but I'm actually old as fuck. So I got tons of grays, but I gotta cover them up so I seem like this wide-eyed ingenue and not the old salty curmudgeon that we all know me to be deep down inside.
Ingenue? Really?
Yeah.
All right. So you're old. You're not really a wide... Okay.
Don't
so
call me on,
okay.
Know?
All right. Well, we is there something else you'd like to prepare for the next time we do this segment so that we can be ready for the people?
You know, I had a really great segment prepared for the last show, but then you cut me. And now I don't remember what it was.
It was within an hour. I emailed you and said, could you do it?
It was actually more like 4 minutes, but I had a great idea, and then it was like, well, I forgot it now.
Okay. Are you excited about the Blue Jays?
Yes, absolutely.
What are you looking forward to?
Just like, I hope they make it to the playoffs again because people are nicer.
In Toronto?
Yeah. Like, everyone's like on the same side. It's like, you know, the first day of spring? It's like the first day of spring.
Do people find that when you're walking around Toronto and the Blue Jays or one of our teams is doing well, that everyone seems friendlier and nicer? Does anyone? No.
It's like, maybe it's just me because I'm in such a great mood. I'm just like bopping around and I'm just like in like a 40s musical and like Technicolor and everything's awesome. And then it's just an internal thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best of luck with your team.
Vish, next time just give me a topic and I'll think of a take.
Segment. I say, do you have a take on something? I can't give you the take.
I don't have any opinions.
This is a weird segment for you to have. I gotta say, we're gonna have to retool. Guys, I think we gotta retool Linda's take. It's just, It's good. I like it. I like just talking to you.
So I love chatting fun. With you.
Okay, I think we've done enough.
Okay, that's fine.
How about a hand for Linda, everyone? we have to step away for a moment. When we return, noted journalist and author Hadani Ditmars will be here, so don't go anywhere. Thanks. This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening I Saw the Light, Knight of Cups, The Grand Seduction, The Messenger, Miles Ahead, and more. At the E-Bar on April 20th, see Roxanne Potvin and Aaron Costello. On April 21st, see Fu Manchu and Shy Harry. On April 22nd, attend the 4th Annual Guelph Pride Pageant. On April 23rd, James Hammond presents Unrefined Comedy on the Road. And also on April 23rd, it's my dad's birthday. Happy birthday, Dad! The Bookshelf is an independently owned cultural hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph, Ontario. For more information about the Bookshelf's hours, listings, blogs, directions, accessibility, and to order books from their online store from anywhere in the world, possibly for my dad on his birthday, please visit the newly designed bookshelf.ca. Welcome back to Long Night, everyone. Thanks for being here again. Our next guest is an acclaimed Vancouver-based journalist and the author of this 2006 book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq. She is currently working on a new book called Between Two Rivers, A Journey Through the Ancient Heart of Iraq. Please say hello to Hadani Ditmars, everyone. Hadani Ditmars. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
It's nice to have you all the way from Vancouver. Is that where you live? You actually
yeah,
live there?
It was 20 degrees today, and everyone was at the beach, and some people were swimming.
You were about to get booed by a bunch of people in Toronto. I've never seen that before.
It was a sunny day here. I liked the weather, actually.
Yeah.
Very crisp, and yeah.
Nice.
I got a tan. Really? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was nice. It seemed nice. Well, and Vancouver's good? Is everything good in Vancouver?
You know, I live by the beach, and I
spend.
But because it's Vancouver, I live in sort of like 400 square feet, so I have 20 years of pre-digital archives, you know, journalistic, you know, slide film from Iraq and various things. So I have a really tiny space with a view by the beach. It's very Vancouver. But I spend most of my time locked away typing, and then you can find me walking on the beach, usually in the morning when I Facebook friends in Iraq. Iraqis seem to have only, they've discovered Facebook chat because it's actually an easy way to communicate, and it's better reception than the mobile network.
Oh, okay.
So I'll be, you know, you can find me on most mornings walking along the beach with all these people walking their dogs, and I'll be talking to someone in, you know, in Baghdad or in Babel or Nasiriyeh.
Okay, so nice.
It's a little bit of a surreal thing. It's like, you know, the West Coast and the Middle East. It's very far away, one from the other.
I understand so. That. I've seen maps. That's true.
Toronto
they are
feels
far.
A little bit closer somehow to things, closer to the center of things.
Now, you're working on this new book that I know you're very excited to talk about, and I'm just wondering, because I understand it's sort of related to this book that came out in 2006, 10 years ago. Can you talk about the relationship between this book and the one you're working on?
So, the first book really was a kind of before and after narrative. I first went to Iraq in 1997. I was writing for the New York Times, and at the time, the sort of dominant media narrative was about the weapons inspectors in Saddam. And that was a bit of a ridiculous cat and mouse game, as we found out later as well, thanks to Hans Blix. The weapons thing was a bit of a ruse. And it was just kind of a very boring story because there was only so much back and forth and, you know, how much copy could you file. So at that time, I ended up missing a tour, an organized media tour of the palaces one day because I slept in. And
typical Vancouverite. Slacking.
Well, it was like, it was one of these surprise Stalinist minder things where it was like...
I hate those.
You know, yeah, it was like 7 in the morning, you know, someone kept ringing my telephone. I figured it was just a wrong number.
And
it was
probably Stalin.
One of the minders saying, come, we're, you know, we're putting you all in a bus and we're going to some surprise place, and they would surprise us. So I was like, oh, no, I've been up late filing. So that day, instead of going to the palaces, I wandered into the press center, which was this interesting place that any journalist who was there in the pre-regime change days will remember well. It was like a weird little souk. It was like a tightly fitted bazaar full of spooks and these minders who were really spies for the Ministry of Information in double-breasted suits and Saddam mustaches. And there were little booths, like, you know, AP had their little booth, and, you know, Reuters had their booth. So I wandered in, and there was only one minder left, and he turned out to be the nephew of Tariq Aziz. He was a Christian, and we started chatting because no one was around, and it became sort of less formal. And he was a student of literature, and so we had this whole talk about Najib Mahfouz and the Egyptian literature. And then he said, "Oh, well, I'll take you to the book market," because it was a Friday. And so we wandered into Mutanabi Street, went to the Poets Cafe. I saw this incredible architecture there, and I just kind of fell in love with the whole cultural story that most of the news hounds weren't really, you know, talking about. And you just had this incredible feeling of, you know, I'm in Mesopotamia, and there's this incredibly rich modern culture, and it's not.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Being talked about. I mean, people are fixated with Saddam, Saddam, Saddam. It was almost as if, you know, 35 million people were all Saddam Hussein, you know. there was such a caricature of what Iraq was. So I guess that was kind of an inspiration for the book. I thought, I've really got to write a book about Iraqi culture,
right,
and people, and not just this bizarre, you know, caricature Saddam obsession, you know, as if he represented the whole nation. I mean, God, imagine if with our previous prime minister, we were all Harper, you know? I mean, that would be frightening.
I think a lot of us were.
Were we? I wasn't.
That's how I felt some days.
Grounding
my children, you know? Yeah. Stop that.
I'd like to be like Justin. I'd like to have that, you know, boxing body and yoga and everything. I'm not quite there yet.
He's hot stuff, that guy.
Yeah.
People talk about that.
I wouldn't mind being Justin. That would be okay. But anyway, so there I was in this police state with this crumbling infrastructure, because at the time the sanctions, as you know, were, well, maybe not, I don't know. Remember Madeleine Albright saying it was worth the price? You know, 500,000 children died.
Yeah.
Why? Because of these draconian UN sanctions,
right,
that blocked things at the border that could have been dual use. There's a whole chapter on public health in my book you'd probably find really interesting. So along with, you know, things like stethoscopes, oxygen bottles, chlorine for water purification, right, because it could have had a dual use.
Sure.
So, you know, you had a desert country where you weren't allowed to import chlorine. So 500,000 children died of waterborne illnesses,
right,
that were totally preventable. So there was this tragedy unfolding. And I discovered that the way to tell the story of Iraq was really through the cultural filter. So, you know, going to Mutanabi Street and interviewing these professors and scholars who were tearfully selling their collections of books of Walt Whitman poetry or of Najib Mahfouz, or, you know, because there's this proverb in Arabic which is, Egyptians write, Lebanese publish, Iraqis read. So they really were the intellectuals of the Middle East,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
voracious readers. But because of the sanctions and the 3,000% devaluation of the dinar and the economic collapse, people were selling their prized book collections to pay for basics like food and medicine. So Iraq, which had the best public health care and education system in the Middle East, suddenly, after, you know, year six into sanctions, infant mortality rate was on par with sub-Saharan Africa. whereas before it had been like Greece or something.
Right.
So this tragedy was unfolding, but there was still this vibrant culture. And again, Iraq was still secular. You know, it was a police state, but it was still secular. So I went to Christmas Eve in this Chaldean church. There's a whole chapter on Christians in that book, and this picture of this altar boy with a candle. Not Saddam Hussein, an altar boy. You know, this is the face
of
Iraq.
It's easy to get an altar boy and Saddam Hussein confused for one another. So, I understand.
So this was still a time. This was a time when, children were dying of waterborne illnesses that were preventable because of the sanctions. People were selling their book collections to pay their rent. There was economic collapse. Saddam was in power, but there was still this incredible theater scene.
Well, this is what I'm curious about, because you are in a zone where there's so much volatility and it's war torn and there's sanctions, but arts and culture are currency. Arts and culture you figured out that this is going on and that we didn't know about it. I mean, that's an amazing aspect of this story.
Well, under sanctions, actually actors in successful plays made more money than doctors. The sanctions.
Now, Karis, how do you feel about that? Does that make sense?
Very nervous.
What are your acting skills like? But the thing is, you know how they always say economic downturn is good for the arts? Because the rents are cheap and everything, but also with those oxygen bottles and stethoscopes and spare parts for generators and chlorine for water purification blocked at the border was also film processing chemicals. So the film industry and cinemas, and you couldn't import film. And
right.
So a lot of old cinemas closed down and became theaters, because all you need to create theater is just humanity, and wit and
that's something we forget. I think when we watch the news or we read about reports from these areas, it's that there's people trying to get on with their lives and find joy.
But the theater was a great escape, and it was also subsidized, so it was still kind of affordable, and it was kind of the only entertainment around, and it was also the only really forum for political critique, because you could get away with double meanings. And like one play that I write about in Dancing in the No-Fly Zone in the theater chapter was about a set in the Ottoman era, and there was a corrupt sultan, and it was really about Saddam, but you could get away with it with kind of double entendre,
right,
and that kind of thing.
Right.
So that was kind of my great discovery. And then I went back in 2003, because I wanted to write this book for many years, but publishers are only interested in the culture of places when they're being bombed, apparently. So it was the invasion of Iraq in 2003 that brought about an interest from a publisher in Canada, and then I went back after the invasion in October of 2003 to kind of find out what had happened to all these people.
Right.
And that was a window where it was just kind of safe enough to wander. Now I'm facing this reality of, I'm inshallah going to Iraq in a few weeks. In fact, an Iraqi friend is here now, possibly. I don't know if Amir is here.
Yes, you're going.
Yet.
When are you going?
Soon. The thing is
Shouldn't
that...
Shouldn't you know when you're going? I like to plan things. Like, I knew I was coming here tonight from Guelph, and I planned it. It was in my calendar.
It's not an easy thing. I've got a visa that's good until May 18th.
Oh, okay.
But I've been dealing with Iraqi bureaucrats, which...
Oh, anyway. I hate that.
And I'm trying to figure out a way to do it safely, and also in a way that I can really have contact with people. So the new book, Between Two Rivers, a Journey Through the Ancient Heart of Iraq, is, I'm very happy to say, I.B. Torres, the great UK publisher, is publishing it. And they also publish, posthumously, Freya Stark.
Right.
Whose Baghdad sketches I've been rereading. And it's incredible, because she was one of the first women, Western women writers, to go and kind of live with Iraqis and write about Iraq. And she was very courageous, and she traveled cheaply in service taxis like I did, and spoke Arabic as much as she could, and really. But there's a resonance with these issues that were still, that were at play in the 1930s that still are today. So it's quite interesting to read that. But this new book is basically framed as it's a political travelogue using ancient sites as a narrative device to tell the story of Iraq. Because, you talk about Iraq as a country of 5 million displaced, and millions of widows and orphans, and people just tune out. But when you talk about Babylon or Ur or the Ziggurat, they'll go, oh, that's interesting.
Right.
So I'm kind of using that as a narrative device to tell the story of Iraq today. But I also want to tell the story of Iraq, as I did in my first book, really paying homage to the Ruhe Iraqiye, to the soul of the country, as a place that is the cradle of civilization, that was the cradle of civilization, but that still has a very vibrant modern culture. Because this secular culture has been really diminished since the regime change, but it's still alive. There's this tremendous protest culture going on right now, which is really underreported. There are artists and galleries and theater and amazing things going on in very, very difficult conditions.
Well, I mean, I'm just mindful of the time, but this sounds very fascinating. And do you have a sense of when this book will be out? I know you have a crowdfunding site, right?
Well, I'm working on it. This is the new publishing reality, even when you have a great publisher. It's expensive to travel to Iraq these days because of security concerns. So I'm working with an NGO that works with displaced people. And actually, they have a program where they work with displaced youth who have been, you know, trapped in camps forever and don't know their own patrimony. They've never been to Babil. They've never been to Ur. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to travel with them to their projects, which happen to be in places where there's ancient sites, and I'm going to tell the story of these displaced people, especially the youth, and at the same time, they're taking them to visit the sites. So I will be seeing these sites, sometimes for the first time for myself, and first time for these young people. So I am going to be launching a crowdfunding site on Indiegogo in the next few weeks. And in the meantime, if anyone's interested in finding out more about it, you can just go to my website, which is my name, www.hadanidittmars.com.
Your first name is www. That's a, that's a remarkable coincidence.
I changed it a few years ago.
Amazing.
Yeah, I
wanted
to, you know, easier to click on,
that's,
you know.
That's
easier
very
to spell than
handy.
Hadani.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If you don't know how to spell my name, remember dancing in the no-fly zone, and then Google that, and you'll get my name, and that's my website
Wait
and
a
my
second.
Email.
Sorry. Okay. Right. Google dancing. Okay, I got it.
Yeah, because dancing good. In the no-fly zone is easier to spell than Hadani Dittmars, even though it's easy to spell if
it's
you.
It's a
know.
Lovely name, Hadani
Thank
Dittmars.
You.
I like
Thank
it.
You.
Okay, so for more information, HadaniDittmars.com. How about a hand for Hadani Dittmars, everyone? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're just going to take a very quick break, and when we return, we're going to have a chat and I think a performance with author, poet, and rapper Omar Musa. Stick around, everyone. Thank you for being here once again. The 231st Kazoo Show is an all-ages licensed three-band bill featuring Proto Martyr, Duchess Says, and Start Something, and takes place Tuesday, May 3rd at the E-Bar in Guelph. The E-Bar is not a physically accessible location and is located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. The show is $10 at the door, and for more information about it, please visit kazookazoo.ca. All right, we're back on Long Night, everyone. Thank you once again for being here at the Transact. We're at the Transact. And not the, where do we normally do this, James?
The Great Hall.
The Great Hall, which is a lovely venue. Is it a lovely venue?
It's got charm.
Yeah, it does have charm. It's nice. I actually like it very much. We're not there. I want to mention, I mean we're not there tonight. And it was a nice segue into what I was about to say, which is that we're actually taking this show on the road. To Newfoundland. Yeah.
To where?
The next episode of Long Night takes place in St. John's, Newfoundland.
Wow.
For a live taping.
Is everyone going?
Yeah, everyone's going. I'm just going to start an Indiegogo thing, and then we'll all go. Maybe we can tap into her dough.
Yeah. A lot of dough in your mouth.
St. John's, Newfoundland, live taping at the Rocket Room at the Lanya Vanya Festival on Friday, May 6th. And I have another announcement. This is new. It sounds like I might be doing a Creative Control episode live at the Hillside Festival in Guelph, which is very exciting. That's the weekend of, weekend of July 22nd, so please check those out. All right, I'm very excited about our next guest. He's an outspoken and gifted poet, rapper, and author who originally hails from Queanbeyan, Australia. His latest book is a riveting poetic novel called Here Come the Dogs. Please make some noise for Omar Musa!
Thank you.
Nice. How about a hand for the bicycles? Doing a little GNR there. Omar, do you have some connection to the song Paradise City that I don't know about?
Not at all. I'm just, you know.
Bikes? Just random? Is a song you knew. Okay, normally they do a thing. And I mean, you seem like a guy who would spend time in Paradise City.
I'm just a dreamboat.
You are. There's already some cheering from my parents. That's weird. No, it's nice.
They got good taste.
Welcome back, or welcome rather, to Toronto. Have you been here before?
Thank you. No, I've never been here before. First time, yeah. Like, I didn't know what to expect.
What do you make of our city?
It's good, man. I like it. There's a lot of good food, multicultural city. I kind of expected it to be like a Drake music video or something. Like when I walked in, you know what I mean? Like when I got into immigration, and I always have a hard time in immigration because I've got that Bin as my middle name.
Right.
Omar Bin Musa.
You're Omar Bin Musa, yeah.
So I kind of did that Hotline Bling dance, like sort of shimmied through immigration. That's didn't take too kindly to it.
What you did, really? Did you... Was that a strategy you employed?
I feel like it's a strategy I should just try and employ in life in general. Just walk down the street. It would bring cheer to people, I feel.
You are a massive hip-hop fan. Obviously, Toronto's having more than a moment at this point. Are you immersed in what's going on in our city in terms of hip-hop?
Not really, but I want to find out. I want to find out about it because I was chatting to some people today, this morning, who were telling me that actually there was a very thriving scene in the 90s that was very much influenced by Caribbean music and kind of patois. That's kind of changed, like when BET became massive over here, the hip-hop became very much influenced by America.
Well, you've likely experienced the same thing where you're from, right? Did you find that there was an Americanization of the form?
Well, I mean, it's an American form.
It's an American form, that's true, sorry.
But yeah, like there was a kind of early debate in Australian hip-hop about whether you should rap in your Australian accent or an American accent, and you know, there were these kind of divided camps. I never took it too seriously. But I rapped in an American accent for the first few songs that I made, and then I was kind of like, what the hell am I doing?
Now,
like, I sound ridiculous. I spoke in my real Australian accent, mate, you know?
Whose American accent would you say you were emulating? Because, because there are different, obviously there are different American accents as there are in different parts of the world.
Yeah, I was very much drawn to West Coast hip hop, so I kind of wanted to be an Australian Ice Cube or Dr. Dre.
Nice. a bit of a drop.
So like Ice Cube, you know, I would kind of just yell into the mic with this deep kind of voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it felt to me like a lot of the white Australian rappers had very nasal Aussie voices. And I had a big voice, so I wanted to emulate those guys.
Now, what about Iggy Azalea? She's from Australia.
You're stitching me up with this one.
No one likes her. No one seems to like her in
rap music. I kind of dealt with this. I did this interview on Q
this
morning.
Oh, yes, that's
morning,
right. You were with my friend Chad today, yeah.
I ripped into Iggy Azalea. I feel like she's a strange figure. I described it on the radio today as verbal blackface, what she does. She is someone who is obviously very drawn to black culture, but maybe the glamorous elements of black culture, who sort of battens down the hatches and becomes defensive when asked to talk about stuff that's a little bit more serious.
Right.
But, at the same time, I was thinking about today because I ripped into her so brutally on the radio from coast to coast, and I was thinking that maybe I wasn't being overly harsh, but at the same time, I feel like Iggy comes under more fire than other people because she deals with a lot of misogyny that a lot of male rappers don't deal with. Like, I feel like she comes under more fire because she's a woman. Like, there's this kind of interesting added layer. Like, there are the kind of legitimate concerns about her and the problematic side to Iggy. But then there's this kind of disgusting, venomous, poisonous kind of misogyny that people hurl at her as well. That would never be an issue, say, with, like Vanilla Ice. You know what I mean? Like, he came under a lot of fire back in the day, but no one was talking about what his body looked like or whatever. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So it's kind of it's a complex issue.
Clearly. But you still, you went after
trying
her
today. Trying to get my head around it.
No, I know. And I mean, you probably weren't expecting to have to deal. You thought probably you're going to have to deal with a lot of questions about Crocodile Dundee, right? Not Iggy Azalea.
Paul Hogan, he's my
cousin. Is he a hero? No, is he?
He's the Prime Minister of Australia right now.
he was a big deal in the 80s here. Did you know that? Did you know that Paul Hogan was
born late in the 80s, so I don't know too much about that.
Yeah. No, I didn't.
No, it was 84.
I actually made a note, do not ask about Paul Hogan, and then it just came up. Right. I'm sorry, he was a big deal.
I love Crocodile Dundee.
I do too. Yeah. That's why I wanted to bring
it
up.
Good.
Anybody? Crocodile Dundee?
No?
Silly. Just ridiculous. Yeah. Now,
ripe for ridicule.
I have been immersed in the world of this book. It's a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
And it's really vivid. It's frenetic. It's hypnotic. How fantastical is this landscape? How much is this grounded in some reality that you can, that you've experienced?
Well, yeah, I grew up in a small town similar to the one that I describe in this novel, where there are migrants from all around the world trying to forge a life for themselves in Australia. I grew up around a lot of young men who felt marginalized and powerless, like the characters in the book. But I tried to take the specifics of my hometown and kind of magnify and distort them and enlarge them and to create kind of a fever land or a dreamscape.
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
I wanted to heighten it and take it into the realm of myth. Because sometimes Australia feels that way to me. It sort of feels like this fiery, combustible place where I'm not sure quite what is reality or what is a nightmare or a dream, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of, I took parts of my life and the history of my town and the specifics of my town and then, you know, changed them to something
else. Amplified them
through that kind of alchemy of poetry, I guess.
Well, it's prose, it's poetry, it's very gritty. On some level, to me, even maybe stereotypically by the artwork, this is a hip-hop novel, right?
Right.
Would you say that?
I mean, I guess so. Like, I was trying to deal with hip-hop. I was trying to take it seriously in this novel, you know? It comes under a lot of ridicule, gets a bad rap. Particularly growing up, like, Australian hip-hop, it wasn't taken seriously, you know? People would laugh at you for rapping in your accent. They would say, that's not something that Australians should do.
No, wait a minute. You've mentioned this before. Are Australians laughing at you for rapping in an Australian accent? Who is laughing at you? Where are they? Can we find them?
Yeah.
We should hurt them.
Yeah, we definitely. I'm up for a punitive expedition of some sort.
There's a dialogue in this book among the main characters talking about accents, as we were discussing earlier, and how someone sounded more American than Australian, and how the Australian accents kind of sound a bit corny, right?
Right.
So what? This was real. Like, how do you overcome your accent? Because it sounds like to me that you tried to adopt an American accent, but then you circle back around when you realize it was more genuine.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there are a few kind of breakthrough acts who started to make some music that was a little bit more accessible to larger audiences, and then people were kind of just like, oh, cool, yeah, actually the Australian accent doesn't sound so bad.
Right.
But then weirdly in Australia, it kind of got co-opted by some of these kind of nationalistic, jingoistic Aussies who were just like, oh, bloody hell, yeah, Australian hip-hop, and it could be sort of like the soundtrack some of their strange prejudices.
Had an underlying nationalism thing happen.
Yeah, so it's a weird thing, you know, like when it kind of this culture and this music gets transported to another country. But I would say, yeah, I mean, it's the first novel in Australia that's dealt with the thriving hip-hop culture and graffiti culture in Australia. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's part of our job as storytellers is to look for stories where they haven't been looked for before and to kind of extend sympathy where it hasn't been extended before. You know?
Yeah, it does feel like you're trying to show the world a whole other side of Australia. It seems like this is something you took upon yourself in this book. Why was it important to you to show us this side of what we think is a place run completely by little koala bears?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Australia sometimes likes to present itself to the world as a place that is egalitarian, that has a very shiny veneer, and there's these kind of blonde babes lazing around on Bondi Beach getting bronze tans and whatnot. And that there's either the kind of majesty of the outback or this coastal idylls. But, you know, a lot of us didn't grow up like that. We grew up in the suburbs, we grew up in flats. We were part of ethnic minorities that were trying to figure out what the hell to do in Australia. I want to delve further into what it means to be Australian, the complexities and the messiness of my country. You know, I'm not interested in these shiny kind of postcards that people try and present, because that's not the reality. You know, just as there are, I'm sure, many stereotypes about Canada that are totally untrue and that there's a lot of darkness going on underneath the surface.
The weird,
that's what's interesting to me.
The weird thing about every Canadian stereotype is that they're true.
You are very friendly.
It's very strange. Of every country, like every name. What do you think of when you think of Canada? I'll tell you if it's true or not. You said friendly.
Friendly.
Yeah.
People are friendlier here. There's less guns, I guess. So, like, even if you.
Yeah.
Like,
that's
than
true.
In America, like, I did notice that, like, that kind of difference. Like, it's less violent here, it feels like.
Yeah.
Well, at least if you don't like someone, if you decide to be unfriendly, kind of can't do as much about it.
No.
What do people think of Trudeau? Like, do people genuinely love this guy? Like, it seems like everyone's just in this honeymoon.
There's
period.
A lot of cynicism about Trudeau.
Right.
There's a lot of people who are very happy that we've moved on from the last guy and his policies. But there is a lot of cynicism because every couple of weeks something he promised he would try to do. It turns out he can't do it.
Right.
So there is a bit of pushback now. Okay. But and also, your media in particular, he went to Washington, which is the first time a prime minister has gone to Washington in, what was it, 30 years or something?
And really? A Canadian prime minister?
Yeah, I don't know what the hell that was about. What did we do? But they didn't go. I don't know why they didn't go. It's very close.
I can see that. I mean, it's so weird. Like, there are these kind of messianic figures, you know what I mean?
And yeah.
Like, we look at it from Australia and we're like, God, I wish we could have someone like that. Because
who's your guy? Who do you got?
This guy called Malcolm Turnbull.
Oh, he's terrible, isn't he? He's like an awful guy?
The guy before was even worse.
Oh, okay.
but that's Malcolm Turnbull, you know, he seemed all right. He seemed very kind of prime ministerial, but he's under the control of the right wing of his party, so his hands are bound in a
Okay.
way. But anyway.
Now, what was you mentioned that you were trying to show this darker side of Australia. This is reflective of your upbringing. What was your upbringing like? You mentioned that you had some adversity as a minority, but
I mean, yeah, like it's all relative, I guess. Like, I think in many ways I had quite a middle class upbringing. You know, I was very lucky. I came from an artistic family. My mother was an arts journalist who ran a very small free arts magazine, you know, the kind of thing that would be handed out in the mall or whatever. And so we had no money when I was in primary school, ever. We were always broke. But I got to go to a lot of plays, and I got to go to a lot of exhibitions and cabaret and things like this. So in that way, I was very rich. I was very privileged. But then in other ways, you know, when you're an ethnic minority in a white culture, you do feel marginalized. You do feel like you're kind of pushed to the side. And then after September 11th, that kind of changed again. You know, there was a lot of Islamophobia in Australia. And I started to realize, like, wow, I wasn't just an outsider. I was the enemy, you know?
Yeah.
People like me, people with my name, we were the ones that these people are yelling about and screaming about with such hysteria. So, you know, it is adversity for sure. But compared to a lot of people, I had it very...
You feel like you had it okay. Now, you I think I read or heard that your father turned you on to poetry, or your father gave you some guidance towards discovering poetry?
Yeah, well, poetry is kind of a living and breathing art form in Malaysia and Indonesia, as it is in so many places around the world. It's something that people would do spontaneously in the village. You know, my dad grew up in a small shanty town called Sim Sim, which is in East Malaysia, in Borneo. And he and his friends would kind of freestyle these poems and spontaneously pass them between each other. And he found a lot of fun doing that. And actually, my grandmother, who never went to school, she never learnt to read or write. She was living on the streets from the age of 8. She recently told me that she had created 50 poems in her head while she was wandering around the streets that helped her survive.
Your mom was the Jay-Z of Australia.
My grandmother,
basically.
Though. Grandmother. My grandmother in Borneo.
Never wrote anything down, just always in her head.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I like that, actually.
Yeah,
she's kind of the...
You like the...
Like the toothless Jay-Z. Oh man, I just threw her under the bus. She's a very beautiful lady.
Jay-Z.
Very, very beautiful lady.
Jay-Z is he's very famous for never writing anything down. Sometimes I think that shows, but other times he's really solid. Yeah. So okay, so it's in your family. The words are in your family.
I mean, I think it goes through so many societies. It's only like lately that, or at least in Australia, I could see, and in the Western world, where it started to become so much a part of academia, that poetry was perceived as being in an ivory tower and kind of separate from daily life.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, every country around the world, and I think that's why hip-hop has taken a stronghold in so many countries as well, because it naturally links into those kind of oral traditions.
Well, hip-hop is among the most obvious musical forms that empowers people. So I think that there's a sense of asserting your confidence against oppression.
Right.
That's where it came from.
I would agree with that.
And I think that that's why so many other cultures who are feeling that will adopt hip-hop as a platform. It used to maybe be punk for some people, but that's more expensive probably to get going, right? To get all that stuff.
I mean, that's how I got into it. You know, from a young age, I was looking for living, breathing poetry that my father talked about. I couldn't see it in Australia.
Yeah.
And then one day I was watching a documentary about the black Muslims, and I was really into them. I was really into Malcolm X. I would just like watch his speeches all the time, photocopy photos of him, put him in my school diary,
yeah.
Make posters of this guy. And then at the end of this documentary about the black Muslims, there was this section that showed Public Enemy jumping up and down on stage.
I was listening to Fear of a Black Planet on the way here.
Yeah.
Oh, in my car.
Keeping it so real, man.
I'm trying to. I needed something to get me pumped up, and I knew I was talking to you, and yeah. It felt like the right thing.
No, totally. And
it was either that or Midnight Oil.
And it wasn't just the It wasn't just the poetry and the way that they were dressing. It was their boldness and their brashness, and I could tell that they were speaking out against something.
Yeah.
And of course, I couldn't totally relate. You know, I'd never, I'm not African American. I'd never been to where they came from. But I felt like there was a certain type of energy or spirit that they were representing that I could relate to.
There's somehow a way. There's somehow a way just shy of appropriation where you can relate to someone else's culture, isn't there? You know what I mean? Like yeah. you can. I totally like Public Enemy spoke to me when I was a kid. I didn't understand what they went through or what they were talking about, but it spoke to me.
Right.
I could relate to it. So that's it's just interesting that that good art and
yeah,
good culture.
Yeah, there's a distinction between saying you can relate to that struggle and saying that it is your struggle.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's something that Iggy Azalea has had trouble distinguishing between.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, we did a thing earlier sort of where we talked about Canadian stereotypes. I want to ask the panel. We have all experienced Australia in various mediated ways. I talked about Croc Dundee. I'm curious, what's the first thing each of you think of when you think of Australia? And to give you, my guests, a break, we're going to start with James. James, what's the very first thing you think of when you think of Australia?
Michael Hutchins.
From In Excess. That's okay.
What point of his life?
I'm a child of the 80s, so I grew up on In Excess and loved that band. And that was my first, like, Midnight Oil followed shortly after, but I think In Excess was the first band that I knew that was like, they're from this thing that's on that island on the other side of the globe.
Right.
There's like people there and they make music that sounds like this.
True.
Right. Okay.
They have
that's
awesome hair that you will never ever have, no matter how often you go to the barber and say, I want that hair.
Thank you very much, James. Karis, what about you?
So for me, it's Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Ooh,
and
good one.
One of my favorite lines of all time, which is a cock in a frock on a rock. So.
Oh, yeah.
I love that line.
Nice. Okay. Very nice. Thank you. Hadani?
Well, I actually lived in Australia in 1989. I took the bus across the country in the summer.
Is that an achievement?
I was 20.
Oh, it's gross. Is
and
it?
It was actually quite beautiful because I'd wake up in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night and the stars would be upside down. And it was just, I loved it actually. And I lived in Perth for 6 months and had like an Australian rock star boyfriend and
was it Michael Hutchins?
Yeah,
it wasn't Michael Hutchins, but I think they were related by 6 degrees of separation.
It was Priscilla.
He was in a band called Fremantle Doctor. I loved Perth. I loved the vibrancy, the multiculturalism, the great arts scene.
Oh, nice.
I was going to emigrate there, and then, I don't know, I turned, you know, you had to be under 26 and various other things happened, and then it was too late. Maybe I'll go back there. I loved Australia,
okay, well,
especially the West Coast.
Didn't realize you had a personal connection. That's amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about you. Is there a misperception about Australia that is often, you know, conveyed that you're just tired of? Like, what would you like people to stop asking you about when it comes to Australia?
Oh, there's that Foster's one. Someone even said it tonight. They were just like, I think they've got Foster's on tap here. I was like, we don't drink that. Like, no Australian drinks.
Can you do the rest of our interview in a Canadian accent?
No, sorry. I shouldn't have done that. I hate it.
No, it's great.
Sorry. My apologies.
I think they got Foster's here, eh? Yeah. Like, you were very close.
I'm sorry.
Very close.
You know what? Drake does this all the time, and it really pisses me off.
What
like,
does he do?
He goes to England and, like, always tries to speak in an English accent. And
he does?
And it's one of the most kind of embarrassing and shameful things I've seen someone do.
I'm sorry.
Well, I just did it before and I'm never doing it again.
Okay, it's fine. So you want people to stop thinking that you guys chug cans of Foster, smash them on your head and throw them to the ground? Is that your deal?
Ride kangaroos around.
Right.
You know, I haven't been in Canada long enough. Like in America, people have all these misperceptions. They're kind of like...
They can be kind of dumb. We can be dumb.
They, you know, someone asked me recently, like within the last month, they were saying, I was on the internet the other day. You know what that is, right? Like, you have that in Australia. And I was like, yeah, we have the internet. Like, it's not just two cans connected by a piece of string. Like, what the hell do you think we have?
Wow.
You know what I mean? It's madness.
That's weird.
But, like,
wait, doesn't your Wi-Fi go in the opposite direction? Sorry. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, good.
I'm here for another few minutes. No, okay, so Australia is good. Everyone loves Australia. We're fine.
Well, yeah. Everything
that was the moral of that segment, I guess. Okay. Now, I understand... before we get to this, I want to know what's next for you, because this is, 2014 this book came out?
Yeah.
Right, so you're a do, buddy. What are you doing?
I know. I'm getting money for old rope is all I'm doing.
What do you got? You got a project? You're working on something?
Yeah, I'm going to put out an EP in the next couple of months. I kind of miss the energy of hip-hop. And then in the next few years, I've already started working on this new novel. That's about a blind Malay transgender sea captain that is leading a journey into the archipelago. We'll have to have a chat about it. Like, so I do this respectfully.
Panel together into one topic.
Yeah. Well,
is there an Iraqi angle?
Well, no, not as of yet. But
I'm
really interested. I felt like I dealt with Australia in this novel, and I want to turn my eyes towards the Malay and Indonesian archipelago.
Right. Okay.
And you know, like nowadays, the powers that be are trying to narrow identities into these kind of rigid things. And I think the history of the archipelago has been one of very fluid identities, whether they be sexual or religious or racial. And so I'm trying to delve into that in the next novel. So it's going to take a while, but hopefully I'll get there.
Well, I'm so excited. I mean, this if you haven't, we have copies of this for sale here? We must. No? We do? Yeah, we do. I heard we do. Pick this book up. It's amazing. Now, before we wrap this whole thing up, are you going to perform something for us?
Should I perform something for you guys?
This was not necessarily something I expected to happen, so this is very exciting. Thank you. What are you going to do?
I'm going to do a poem called Fireflies. I was trying to have a connection to Toronto, and I wrote this after seeing a friend of mine from here who wrote a status on Facebook about fireflies, and so I wrote this whole poem about it.
Oh, nice.
And a side note is that I got a call about this poem from a very familiar Australian voice, like from an unknown number, and it turned out it was Russell Crowe, who just loves this poem, apparently, and loves Australian poetry. So there's a massive name drop for you.
Wow.
But just in case any of you guys don't like what I did tonight, but you needed some celebrity validation, then there it is.
Wow, that's remarkable. Fireflies. Okay, let's hear it.
She said, as a child, I lived in the mountains. I used to collect fireflies in a jar and use the light to read my books. I said, what a beautiful world it is. She said, now when I return to the mountains, there are no fireflies left. And I said, what a heartbreaking world it is. So when our heroes grow old and our dreamers go mad, when our songbirds go silent and fires burn on each corner, I live for the little winds. When there are hands over ears and tape over mouths, when I no longer know if I prefer to be awake or asleep, the silence of the undertow or the crashing of waves on a reef, when they promise us everything and they treat us like nothing. I live for the little wins. Like when you eat a meal and straight afterwards you realize that what you just ate, shit, sis, that was exactly what you felt like. You know what I'm talking about. Like when mangoes are $9 a box. I actually did this poem recently in Thailand, and they were just like, $9, bloody extortionate. Anyway, it's all relative. Like a surprise email that makes your day, like the first sip of water after a day-long fast during Ramadan, like the first line after writer's block, like a student who can barely spell her name but pens the perfect line. You see, I live for the things I'm ready to die for. I stand for the things for which I'm willing to fall. We all promise that to ourselves sometimes. We, the people, most fragile of all. We, the people, who drag nets to the shore hoping to find diamond rings in the guts of fish and pearls in the bellies of dragons. We, the men and women who stand inches from screens that scream at us to lose weight or gain funds. We, the seething mass of darlings and friends, rapists, racists, killers of men, romper stompers, heroes, fashionistas and feminists, protesters who swing their bats at the system, hoping the shards form mosaics, and lovers who swing for the fences. You see this poem? This poem right here? It's dedicated to the outsiders, to the outcasts, to the eccentrics who never let coolness whitewash their madness. This is for the kids on the mish, on the pavements, in the basements, in the flats, and in the schoolyards. It's for the poets who write this is for poems, my friends, in Toronto. This poem is for you, because they will treat your voice like a crime for which you have no alibi. So make it a crime of passion. raise it at their eyes, shoplift time, pickpocket perseverance from the haters, and leave the rest behind. Speak, speak, speak with purpose. Teeth brighter than a city spine. Little win though it may be, who knows? Perhaps someday, one day, the fireflies will return. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Omar, that was lovely. Thank you. How about another hand for Omar Musa? You can follow Omar Musa on Twitter at OBMMusic, and that's our show. We are done. I want to thank all of my guests for being on the program. How about another round of applause for everybody on stage? Once again, if you can, come out to our next tapings, May 6th at the Lanya Vanya Festival in St. John's, Newfoundland. Follow us on Twitter at Vish Khanna, at Vish Creative, and at Spurfest. And that's the show. Thanks so much for watching us and listening. Good night, everybody. It's nice to see you. Bicycles.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.